Hello, and welcome to Northwestern Exposure, a weekly look at whole systems approaches to issues affecting individuals and communities in the industrial world. I'm Paul Nelson. Once upon a time, a young girl went down to the river to fetch some water. What she found when she returned home and what she did to survive, no ordinary tongue can tell. Fortunately, we have creative people like Eric Drucker to tell the tale in a form that predates language, yet is perfect for generations raised on TV. A story without words. A graphic novel. Blood Song is the name of the new work by artist Eric Drucker, who was raised in the East Village, where other creative types lived and rode the bus when Eric was growing up.
Guy comes in with a big black beard, kind of balding. And my mother said, "You see that guy in front of us? He sat down right there. That's Ginsberg. He's a famous poet." And I didn't know what to think. What does this mean? What's the significance? What does a famous poet do all day? You know, write poems? But then I would see him over the years. And when I got to be around 11 or 12 years old, I started to check out and books like Kaddish and Howl. As a teenager, I started to read some of his poetry, and it spoke to me.
Eric ended up collaborating with Allen Ginsberg, whose politics resonated with a young man. Eric also believes his work has the ability to resonate with a wide variety of people.
One of the goals of doing these wordless novels is that I'm transcending any language barrier. Theoretically, anyone would be able to understand the story. Blood Song, a child would be able to understand it. I think whatever background you're from, age group, it's kind of a universal. Well, art, I think art is a universal language.
Blood Song, a silent ballad, is the new work by Eric Drucker. We'll talk about the history of this genre, Eric's politics, and the story itself, which, unfortunately, continues to be relevant for Americans and oppressed people around the world. Eric Drucker and his new graphic novel, Blood Song, on today's program. Thanks for tuning in. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, then the effort of our next guest is worth about 200,000 words. Telling a tale that is ancient yet as relevant as today's headlines, Blood Song is a book that its creator calls a silent ballad. A book in the genre of graphic novel that extends the work of Franz Masureel and Lind Ward. Eric Drucker is a third-generation New Yorker whose block print-like posters publicize the struggles of squatters and other less fortunate people in that city so well, he caught the attention of Allen Ginsberg and eventually collaborated with the legendary poet. His work has been featured in The Nation, Village Voice, and Newsweek, the cover of The New Yorker, and has done album covers for such artists as Rage Against the Machine. He's our guest today to discuss his graphic novel, the issues covered in the novel, and the genre in which he is extending. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Pushing ahead the notion of the graphic novel, which I don't know too much about. And so in our first segment, I'd like to talk more about the genre in general. And then in our second segment, we can talk more about the specifics regarding Blood Song, which is beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, you like looking at the pictures. It's a break from all the text, all those words that often get in the way of telling the story.
You know, it's funny. For a second, I thought, well, how am I going to do an interview if, you know, there are no words, there's no themes? But, of course, there are themes that we can discuss. And, you know, we get hit up with, offers to do interviews all the time. And I saw this one, and I picked it up and just started looking at it. And I read, quote unquote, the whole thing in one setting there, and I have a sense that I could go through it many times. But you know what I'd like to talk about is how you were first introduced to the graphic novel as a kid. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I was introduced. I guess I was about 11. Couldn't have been more than 12 years old. My grandfather, who was up in the Bronx, visited me one day, and he had these two books with him by an artist named Franz Masureel. I'd never heard of him, and the name didn't have any significance. I was just struck by the pictures, and as I flicked through the book, I always like looking at the pictures, right? But then there were, I realized that there were no words at all, and that the entire novel was told in a series of woodcuts. And it was a full, like, reading experience. It was a full, like, in-depth novel, adventure story called Passionate Journey. This was done back in, I think it was in the 20s. Franz Masureel was a Belgian artist. He's often lumped in with the German Expressionists because he did that woodcut, kind of angular style, and he often had political themes in the work. It was Europe between World War I and World War II. And so that was a revelation to me that you could even do this, that you could have a whole book that's not for kids, but like an adult novel that you could sit down and spend hours with, just looking at all of the visual detail. And I guess I didn't put them aside and didn't really, didn't obsess over it, but it struck me just as a concept because I was an artist even at this age. I've been drawing and painting since I was a little kid, since I can remember, I guess, pictures of my first language.
And a seed was planted.
That's what it felt like, that a little like a light bulb went off and kind of registered for some future purpose. It didn't really occur to me that I would maybe attempt this myself at some point, but it did strike me that, what a novel idea, a novel without words.
R. Crumb was also an early influence.
I stumbled upon R. Crumb and Zap Comics at the tender young age of 10, because I was living down in the East Village going to school down there, and some of the alternative bookstores, the East Side Bookshop, would have the full display of underground comics. So I came across them, and that was also a big eye-opener right around that time. And that was something that I gravitated more to, much, much more, probably because of all the sex and the drugs and rock and roll and just the sheer liberation of the form of comic strips, that cartoon characters could take their clothes off and get naked and do things and get into like political situations. I hadn't seen this. I hadn't seen Jimmy Olsen, behave in such fashion.
This was not in the New York Times.
It wasn't in the time. Linus and Charlie Brown, they were usually pretty well behaved. So R. Crumb, totally, blasted blasted right through it, all of those boundaries.
So I'm guessing the late 60s, early 70s is what we're talking about.
That's right. Around 1969, 1970, and I was just around 10, 11. That was a big turning point when I was exposed to a lot of these ideas.
Grandpa who was progressive, parents who were progressives. Tell us about your progressive.
Well, it was
heritage.
This grandfather. He, back in the 30s, he was an activist. He was in the Socialist Party, as many people, working people in New York City were in that era. If you weren't in the Socialist Party like him, you were in the Communist Party, or you were at least an anarchist or some kind of labor, trade unionist or something. Of course, all of them were fighting with each other all the time. It's been the unfortunate kind of history of the left. They spend more time arguing and debating amongst themselves than uniting against the common enemy, which I guess at this point is obviously the corporations. Corporate globalism. But my grandfather, so he was an influence not only artistically, he was often would bring me books as gifts. He would give me typically art books. And often they would have a kind of a subtle political theme in them, like this Franz Masureel. It would have art that had content as opposed to the abstract art, which was still a pretty prevalent at that point, the New York School, abstract expressionism. I mean,
Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg.
Rauschenberg, and even Pollock, and that whole gang. I felt like we were kind of overdosing on that. I mean, some of that work I can appreciate, but I felt like it was there was such hype about it, and it was almost an example of like the Emperor's New Clothes, where everyone was seeing, like, reading so much into this abstract action painting. And like, what is it really? Is it just individual expression? What is it that's being communicated here?
It was supported by the State Department for diplomatic purposes and covertly by the CIA.
Yes,
I don't know if you knew
this
that.
This has come out more and more recent years, that those initial shows of abstract art at the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney were sponsored by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which has been revealed as it was a CIA front group. But that would make sense that the CIA or any government would prefer if the art is just abstract and didn't have too much heavy content. Because before World War II, American art was very, very narrative and had this tradition of not only telling stories but of being very political and very topical.
Very working class.
Very working class and, yeah, class conscious. And it got to the point during the New Deal, Roosevelt, with the WPA, where the government was actually paying artists to paint like political murals, Diego Rivera-style murals in the post office walls all over the country, which a few years later, about 90% of them got whitewashed. Right after World War II, we went headlong, like straight into the Cold War. And then that art has been out of fashion ever since. And there's been this abstract thing has been thrust upon us. Some of it, which is good, but I think most of it is a lot of hype.
Masaryk didn't care for the abstract art.
No, he was very figurative the whole time. Again, he was very expressionistic. There was a lot of distortion going on and artistically very strong. But it was in that narrative tradition where it was images of figures, people doing things, interacting with each other. I mean, he was trying to give you some kind of modern day mythology about the times we're living in, war and peace.
A content orientation.
Content.
Yeah. Talking with Eric Drucker, he is the creator of the graphic novel Blood Song, a silent ballad. It's a brand new release, and it's published by Harcourt. I'm Paul Nelson. Ginsberg was someone who you collaborated with, and he was very inspired by your work, and that must have been interesting to have a connection with that old man.
Well, Allen Ginsberg was someone who was there. He was just in the neighborhood. I mean, from when I was a kid, I would see him around. My mother first pointed him out to me on the 14th Street crosstown bus when I was about 8 years old. Guy comes in with a big black beard, kind of balding. And my mother said, "You see that guy in front of us? He sat down right there. That's Ginsberg. He's a famous poet." And I didn't know what to think. What does this mean? What's the significance? What does a famous poet do all day? You know, write poems? But then I would see him over the years. And when I got to be around 11 or 12 years old, I started to check out and books like Kaddish and Howl. As a teenager, I started to read some of his poetry, and it spoke to me right away. I felt like most poetry either went like over my head or just went past me. I guess it still does. But his was the language he used was a language that I understood. The world he described was very familiar to me. It made sense. I mean, he literally lived in the neighborhood, so he was describing a landscape that I was literally familiar with. But also his attitudes. Both of Ginsberg's parents were political activists. His mother was in the Communist Party. Father was in the Socialist Party. They were arguing all the time and finally divorced. But so in that sense, I felt like the collaborations that I did with Allen Ginsberg were very very much of a natural, had a lot of natural harmony because both of us had some similar backgrounds and some similar political attitudes about, you know, anti-war and, you know, critical of not only the U.S. government, but most governments in general, you know, the Soviet Union at the time. Allen was someone who traveled around, you know, to all these countries. He was in Cuba, he was in Czechoslovakia.
And got kicked out of those countries.
Right, was deported from Czechoslovakia and was in Cuba, and Castro kicked him out of Cuba because he kept asking questions about how are homosexuals treated in your country? And they just didn't even want to talk about it. Yeah. So he was someone who would get on the list, you know, the list of almost any government would feel uncomfortable with anyone who asked that many questions.
Dangerous security. Yeah. He talked to me about that on the program. Mm-hmm. You had a chance to merge your background of activism and your art, and that was really the foundation of your work as an artist with the poster art publicizing progressive causes. Agitprop, I guess they'd call it.
Agitprop, it's often called. Well, I was doing a lot of art. I wasn't thinking of it so much as as propaganda or agitprop. These were just issues that were local, right in the neighborhood. Police brutality, or just landlord abuse, landlord terrorism. You know, that was one of my early posters I did. Was, are you a victim of landlord terrorism? And I had this sinister looking landlord, you know, kind of demon character, and a whole string of posters to get people to go come to the tenant meeting, or you know, speak out against this, or against cutbacks in public education, things like this that were very close to home that I felt I felt strongly about. I felt like as a visual artist, this was a language that spoke out very clearly when he printed it up and put it on the street as a poster. It's something that the public will have to reckon with. If you paint a picture, it just ends up in a gallery, and you're only going to be communicating to a certain class of people, you know, or people who would even go into galleries. So I put a lot of attention into creating street posters over the years, especially all through the 80s, late 80s, and all through the 90s in the Lower East Side of New York. And there was never a dull moment there. There was always a lot of action and subject matter to be inspired by, and social contradictions to portray in the art.
You know, in the wake of September 11th, the NYPD baseball hats and fire department hats are sort of a fashion statement, but your experience gives us a different view of the New York City Police Department.
Well, I mean, I think anyone who lives in the city, New York City, or any big or any inner city, put it that way, because it obviously comes down to class, you know, or racial background. You know, how one is treated by the police will vary. I mean, I've had friends who are policemen, you know, but I've also had policemen who have just harassed me on the street for no reason, or just specifically for, you know, putting up a poster. And when Giuliani was elected, he started really cracking down on things that he called quality of life crimes. First, he was going after homeless panhandlers and street peddlers and people like that. Over the years, I had been busted for putting up posters on the street, and I would always plead First Amendment. Aren't you allowed to have freedom of speech, freedom of the press? And they say, okay, but just don't do it again. And then gradually, very incrementally over the years, they started to get more and more punitive. Like, we're going to give you a ticket this time. We're going to confiscate your posters. And then when Giuliani got elected, we're going to place you under arrest. And we're going to, photograph you, fingerprint you, put you through the system. So it became criminalized, in other words. People who put up posters, or graffiti artists who are usually people of color from the inner cities, South Bronx. So it struck me as a double standard, because the city had posters all over the place, ads for Broadway plays, Camel cigarettes, things like that, but that corporations were paying to have put up. And they it's not like they were paying for the advertising space. We're talking about posters that are wheat pasted. So it was obvious that there was selective enforcement going on the street. You know, who would the police bust for putting up a poster? So that kind of informed some of my attitude about police, how there was often this kind of selective enforcement, and they're there. What is the phrase? To serve and protect. We're here to serve and protect. You just add the other words, to serve and protect property, or private property, If you have money, the police will usually be helpful and kind of protect you to some degree. If you're poor, don't have money, or, your money isn't the right color, then look out. They might, not be there to protect you. On the contrary, they might go after you. You might fit the description of someone else, and, next thing you've gotten beaten up. And then the burden is on you to hire a lawyer and to try to say, hey, I was, minding my own business, and the policeman attacked me, and I had a friend, an artist friend, Grady Alexis, who was actually attacked by the police and killed. And that affected me very deeply. It brought it all home to me. You always hear about police brutality, and you don't know how much of that is an exaggeration. But that's when it came home to me. It was someone who I knew to be a very peaceful person. Okay, he was African-American. He was brown-skinned. But hell, a lot of black people in New York City. And I think he got a desk appearance ticket. He was never even charged with like involuntary manslaughter or anything. And I realized, not much justice to be had unless you can afford it. So that's kind of been my education has been on the streets and just from experience and meeting the cast of characters on the street. Again, the cast of characters being some of them policemen themselves. I was doing martial arts for a while, and several of the people in the class were policemen. And I thought, hey, if my old policemen were like this, that would be cool. You know, people who were like down home, who I could communicate with. But then we had people like, there were a lot of students in the neighborhood and a lot of people like, I guess for lack of a better term, you'd call bohemian poet, artists. And they're, I think, always looked at by society with some suspicion.
Yeah, what do they do all day?
Like, what are they doing all day long?
You know, the city of Seattle had its poster ban overturned August 5th, 2002, but it looks like the city is not paying much attention to that ruling since they're trying to recraft the ordinance. Why do mayors and the powers that be dislike these posters?
Well, again, I think it's more the content of some of the posters. If the posters are just for commercial products, they're not even thought of that way. Then it's just, oh, no, that's just advertising. That's legitimate. That's part of our whole culture is, you know, Joe Camel on the highway, you know. Or even someone like Andy Warhol would do, like, art on that subject of Campbell's soup cans and the iconography of something that normally we don't even think of. It doesn't register because it's so ubiquitous in the culture. But when you see a poster or a big billboard that was just done by some people who weren't, you know, advertising and trying to sell a product, but were just simply trying to communicate an expression, either an artistic expression or a point of view or, God forbid, like a political statement, and actually like utilizing their First Amendment rights. They're walking a very, very fine line these days. Very easy to get arrested in cities around the country. There's been this nationwide crackdown, and it's often under some anti-graffiti ordinance.
Or here in Seattle, it's because it was dangerous for utility people who had to go up the poles to work on the wires or what have you.
What, they might slip on?
Yeah, exactly. That was the justification. Yeah. As a third-generation New Yorker, I'm sure you've been asked the 911 question a million times, but let me try a different slant. As an artist, what did you feel your role was after the terror attacks of September 11th?
Well, I felt like, okay, as an artist, what's the gig? It's to communicate. It's to express one's feelings, one's emotions, but it's also I feel like art is communication. It's a language. Which is the subtle difference. I was kind of taught in art school that art is just self-expression. But to me, that's obvious. That's implicit that you're expressing yourself. But I think it's communicate. So what is it that was to be communicated right after 9/11? And there was just a whole flood of emotions and thoughts came to me right after that. I got a phone call a couple of days after 9/11 from Dark Horse Comics. And they were doing a big anthology, contacting the cartoonists and comic book artists around the country to come up with a special like edition, like an anthology, a benefit to raise money for the firefighters and the police and the ambulance workers and the victims of 9/11. And would I do the cover for the book? And I said, I felt like, okay, I have to rise to the occasion. Of course, I'm going to say yes, even though they didn't give us very much time to come up with anything or even process what had happened. In a way, that made it very much more spontaneous. 9/11 was, I think, the magnitude of 9/11 caused people's spontaneous expressions tended to be just purely emotional and not really thought out. You know, like, we're under attack, Americans, we're being victimized But this is like, you know, images of Pearl Harbor came to mind. And although there were elements of that, if you just waited a few days or thought about it for a few weeks, it started to fall into perspective that, okay, just like the radio announcer says, man, have you been down to Ground Zero? It looks like downtown Beirut, as if only downtown Beirut was supposed to look like downtown Beirut. And this is something that happened. This is the result of violence and injustice. There's that saying, you know, all the demonstrations, no justice, no peace. That took on a different meaning. It was almost like some law of physics. If there you don't have the presence of justice, you can't then expect to have peace.
What Dr. King said, a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Right, and he said that peace isn't merely the absence of violence, that it's like the presence of justice. And there's a difference there, you know, when those in authority, specifically you know, presidents, whether as Democrat or Republican, when they talk about peace in the Middle East or wherever, we just want peace, the peace part. But they're not talking about justice. That doesn't come into it. And that just seems so not only short-sighted, but it's bound to fail. If you just like, you know, force people to what just peace, but there's the injustice is going to continue, then it's a matter of time before someone else, you know, opens fire, whether against themselves or takes people down with them. It's almost to be expected, really.
Your website is beautiful. Drucker.com, Drooker.com. And in fact, they can see some of the images from Blood Song.
That's right. That's a quick way of getting a sneak preview of not only this book, but a lot of my work is to look up Drucker.com, Drooker. There's all kinds of images that you could even download, like high resolution images that specifically for this purpose, activists could download the print quality, make posters of them. Leaflets, flyers, things like this. I don't believe in copyright in that sense.
Paste them up all over your town. Eric Drucker's our guest. He is the creator of the graphic novel Blood Song, A Silent Ballad.